I'm Carrie Fountain, and this is Just to Say, where we talk to poets about the poems they make and the poems they love.
Poetry springs forth from authentic human voice.
Poetry is about anarchy, it's about mystery, it's about dreams, it's about, you know, the unknown.
Writing is a way of saying that you and the world have a chance.
Frankenstein love. I think there was a movie once where Frankenstein fell in love with a vampire. A small mummy at first interfered, but later provided the requisite necessary clarifications. He can only meet you at night. Her face is scarred in a permanent expression of doom, but her bolt glows whenever she sees you. The rival for the vampire's affections was a vaguely feminine zombie. Frankenstein felt not very mysterious. Many different feelings cycled below whoever's skin she had been given. Did they even belong to her? In the many pages of the Book of Love, this is only one story, but everyone goes through it once. The main question is, will you be the one unable to control your temper, sewed together as you are from the past, or the one who always ends up turning away in search of another likeness?
I know you just spent a really long time writing a book about poetry, and it's a book sort of a lot about reading and experiencing poetry, but it is also about writing, the experience of writing poetry. What do you do to sort of, as a person, what do you do to sort of make that happen?
This particular poem, actually, over 10 years ago, I met a guy. It was after a reading, and I just sat down next to this guy, and he was really interesting, and I started talking to him. And it turned out he was a painter, and his name is Chris Uphues. And we started talking, and I eventually did some collaborations with him. And the collaborations mainly involved him sending me these digital reproductions of these incredible paintings he does. And one of the paintings is called Frankenstein Love. Mm. The paintings are very involved, and they have these little stories. They look like digital cartoons, but they're actually all hand-painted. And anyway, so there's this story that kind of looks like this Frankenstein-y monster-y figure with this other monster-y figure, and it sort of looks like maybe they're thinking about going on a date or something. And so I just got this little idea and started going with it from the painting.
So in that way, it's... what is that word?
Ekphrastic. Yeah, I guess you could say it's ekphrastic. I mean, it's pretty loosely ekphrastic. Yeah. And I mean, I think that, you know, I could have described something or talk about something and then that it would go nowhere. But mm-hmm. in this case, I think it pretty quickly felt emblematic of a kind of psychic reality that we all feel. And there's this one line in the poem that always embarrasses me when I read it. In the many pages of the Book of Love, this is only one story. I mean, it's so close to being like complete cheese ball, like greeting card language. But it just seemed like also in the poem I felt like I was getting very close to some kind of, you know, primal experience that we have in relationships. And that seemed to be the time to talk in almost this kind of more general way. And I always feel embarrassed when I read it because I feel like people are going to think it's like cliche or something. And maybe it is, but it just felt like the right thing to say at that moment.
That's so funny that you should say that, because when you said there's a line that I knew exactly which line you were going to say.
Yeah,
but it's also the line in the poem where, you know, you're like bopping along. It's funny, you know, it's sort of very engaging.
Yeah.
It's like it has this conversational sense to it. Like, wait, you know, I'm talking about this movie, isn't it? And then there was this little mummy who, you know, it's like you're telling the story of a movie. And then all of a sudden it does take this sort of turn. You know, in the many pages of the Book of Love, this is only one story, which is so absolutely true. And then from there, I think, it really just sharply turns. And, you know, I'm thinking of last night, you know, I have been having my husband, who is not a poet, but he's a playwright, and he's a great appreciator of poetry. And I was reading all of your poems. I really wanted to do April Snow. That's like one of my very favorite poems ever in the whole world. But I said, you know, we've decided on this poem. Will you read it? And I had the experience of sort of handing it to him and then watching him like read it. And I just knew when he had gotten to the end or toward the end, you know, in those two lines, you know, the main question is, will you be the one unable to control your temper, sewed together as you are from the past, or the one who always ends up turning away in search of another likeness. And it's like, my husband's such a great reader of poetry because you can see him experience the poem. So like, mm-hmm. he just like, the just like suddenly tears, you know, he was like, oh my God, that poem. It draws you in by its kind of like funny conversational tone. And then, you know, it's sort of like this emotional mic drop at the end.
Well, I know you know this as a poet because it's true in your own work, but I think there is a point in every poem where you have to make yourself genuinely vulnerable. I mean, not pretend vulnerable, like saying it, but like actually in the language or in the movement of the poem, you have to go deeper somehow. In this case, I really do think it was being willing to get very close to some kind of sentimentality, which is something that I think a lot of poets are so afraid of, you know, or they're afraid of being accused of being like, you know, like I said before, cliched or something. But I just felt like I needed to not be like so funny, and not that I'm so funny, but I mean, I was being kind of like jokey in the poem. And it's like, if I kept going on that way, it just nothing would happen. And it would just stay on the surface. And that somehow you need to just dive deeper in. I mean, a lot of this book was written not too long after the death of my father, and also at the beginning of a new relationship with the person who is now my wife and with whom I now have a child. So there was a lot of thinking going on. There's more thinking going on in this poem, I think, about what it means to really start to get deeper in a relationship and when those things start to come out in yourself that are so unpleasant and deep about, you know, your nature. And how you and your partner have to just start to come to terms with it, or part ways.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, I spent a lot of time, like, thinking about how to talk to you about this poem, and I kept thinking, like, it's a love poem. This is a love poem. Mm-hmm. But then I would think, wait, this isn't a freaking love poem. Like, really, it's like, in the end, it's like, which one are you going to be? Like, the miserable one or the more miserable one, you know?
But that is sort of how a marriage is, right?
Right.
I mean, you're going to be, I mean, if you're going to have a real marriage, I mean, you are going to be, you know, you're going to be your not so great self. I mean, everybody knows that's true. And I think that my wife loves this poem.
Right.
And she, I think it's funny because it's not, you know, one of those poems where I extol her many virtues, which would be easy poems to write. But in this case, it's more about the difficulties. And I think that she likes the reality of that in our relationship. And, you know, I think anyone who's in a longer marriage knows this.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I think is really surprising and so enticing about this poem, because I don't know if you've read this essay that was written a few years ago, and I think it was like kind of controversial or whatever, but I thought this line from it, it was a poem, it was an essay by the poet Tony Hoagland. I can't remember what it was called, but it was about sort of like the sort of different approaches to poetry. And he just says something in this essay. He talks about the difference between the gong of recognition in a poem versus the mm-hmm. bong of disorientation. And in some ways, I think this poem mm-hmm. kind of starts in that, like, you know, area of like, wait, what's going on in this poem? Like, I would never stop mm. reading it, but it's not like, it doesn't begin by announcing itself like, just wait, in seven lines I'm going to render some very substantial meaning about the nature of love, you know? And but then it sort of swings into that, you know, it's sort of, that's one of the surprises, is that you do end up at the end of the poem with this sort of ooh, like, it's like an oof, you know, like, yes, I understand that, yeah. Even if I don't kind of...
Well, I think when you're writing, I mean, I think you just have to do it over and over and over again, and most attempts are not going to result in something. But I think you just train... I just train myself to just try to look for those opportunities to go deeper, like I said, into my own psychic reality and the common psychic reality of our species, as much as you can talk about that. I mean, of course, we all have so many differences, but we're all humans. And so I'm looking for those moments, and sometimes they don't appear. Sometimes I miss them, or I go the wrong way or something, but, you know, and then those poems, nobody ever sees them. mm-hmm. So I just try to, you know, but that is what I'm looking for. I mean, the gong of recognition. I mean, that's really good. And mm-hmm. I would agree that, you know, but you can only find it in yourself. You know, you have to find it in yourself first, as a writer, and then hope that it will resonate elsewhere.
Right. in that poem, I think it's your poem, is it called, do you have a poem in this collection called The Pocket? Is that what it's called? Or is it just called Pocket?
It's just called Pocket.
Pocket. And then there's those great lines in that poem of like, you know, I will stand in an actual stance of mystery and not knowing toward the world, which is my job, right? You know, I think that some people think that poets are there to render meaning, but really poets are there to sort of stand facing the unknown and kind of approach it, you know, and not know where you're going.
And to discover meaning. Yeah, right. I mean, yeah, but in the interest of discovery, I mean, I think that, you know, it's not the same. I think one of the things that happens is that people, they think if you're not, you know, they think, oh, you should know what you're going to say more or less, and then you're using a piece of writing to communicate it. That's not really how poetry works.
Right.
But it just be, if that's, poetry discovers meaning, but to say that isn't to say that poetry doesn't mean anything at all.
Right.
That's ridiculous.
Right.
Any poem that anybody loves or cares about is full of immense amounts of meaning. It's just the kind of meaning that you only find if you go on a genuine voyage of discovery, to use another cliche.
Mm.
But it's not, I don't think that most poets sit and think, you know, I know exactly what I'm going to do, and now I'm just going to enact it in language. That's just not how poetry seems to work or what it's for, in my experience, both as a writer and a reader.
Do you think that in your experience as a teacher and sort of a poet in the public, that many people think of poets as doing that? That are sort of like they know where they're headed and it'll sort of go confidently?
Yeah,
in that direction?
And I think that they're confused. I think that they're confused because I think that they think that's how writing works. They've been led to expect that that's how writing works with good reason. I think there's a reason for that because that's how most writing does work, more or less.
Mm-hmm.
But poetry is different. It takes the material, this material of language that's so often used in one way and sort of torques it or tweaks it or disrupts it or blurs it or turns it inside out, or just uses it for something else. Those are all metaphors, right? They don't mm-hmm. really explain what we do as poets.
Mm-hmm.
But so I think people can feel that transmission from the poet, but they don't trust it because they've been used to listening for other things in language and being told to do other things with language. So there's a kind of wound in many readers. And the purpose of when I wrote Why Poetry, really my goal was to try to, you know, go some way towards like healing that wound a little bit,
mm-hmm.
that people feel that disconnect between what they know in themselves about poetry, which is that they might have fallen in love with one or a few poems, and then all this other information that they have about language that seems to contradict what it can do. So I was just trying to bridge that in the prose book,
mm-hmm.
you know, and also in the poems too.
And isn't so much of that that comes, it's sort of like everyone involved in the crime or the wound inflicting is kind of innocent in their own way, because like, right, so much mm-hmm. of that comes from the way we are taught poetry, which is by like, you know, English teachers who would probably love to spend a lot of time talking about the mysteries of language, mm-hmm. but how am I going to you know, give a quiz over this poem and make sure that my students read it,
right.
You know, like a poem is there to
right.
go and take the meaning out of, and every poem has a meaning, has a like a, you know, a testable meaning that you could like put on a test, you know, or
right.
and you see this has happened again and again. They keep doing these, especially in Texas, because there's all of this testing that is like developed in Texas, where mm-hmm. and this has happened to Naomi Shihab Nye. They did this with her a couple of years ago, where she it was an essay that she'd written, you know, poet writing an essay, mm-hmm. they put it in a test, and then they gave her the questions that were on the test, mm-hmm. and she failed to answer the questions about
yeah.
her own essay correctly.
I'm sure.
You know,
I'm sure she did.
Yeah.
I'm sure I would too. Yeah, I've just started to meet with some teachers. They're teachers who are using my book in classrooms, and I'm just starting to meet with them, and high school teachers. Particularly, I'm so interested in how they teach poetry, given Common Core and other, you know, exigencies, and to maybe try eventually to find a way to help the students do well on the test, but not sell poetry down the river
mm-hmm.
Along the way. That would be a great outcome. I don't know if it's possible, but it's kind of an idea that I have, and so I'm just starting to talk to people. But yeah, I don't blame the teachers at all. It's not their fault. I mean, they have so much pressure, and also most of them aren't trained,
right?
You know, to do that. Yeah. In poetry, they're trained in other things. So yeah, it's tough. Poetry's about anarchy. It's about mystery. It's about dreams. It's about you know, the unknown and contradiction or whatever. It's very hard to give an exam on those things.
Yes, right, exactly. Yeah. But there are things that you can sort of approach, and like it's really great to like sort of learn about what a poet, like learning the definition of syntax. You know, you can like wrap your mind around that. You could write an essay about what syntax is and giving different examples of how it's working or not working in poetry or voice or diction. I know voice is like one that a lot of poets for some reason hate the term voice, but diction is definitely like, you can define diction and you can talk about it and you can sort of see by that, through that lens, what poets are doing. You know, like one of the things that's really charming about this poem, even though you, Frankenstein Love, even though you enter it mysteriously and exit it mysteriously, if you are like willing to read poetry that way, you could also just say like, is Matthew Zapruder here using like high poetic diction or low diction, like everyday speech, and you know, and then you realize like, oh, well, that's one of the things that's so appealing about this poem is that I like feel like we're at a bar or something and we're engaged in the conversation, and then this is one of the little tangential parts of our conversation that, you know, the poet has sort of led me down. And again, that you know, and then that,
I think
No, you go ahead. I was just going to say, that's like one of the reasons why when you, that line that you say you're so worried about, you know, in the many pages of the Book of Love, this is only one story. The diction really changes there, right? It's sort of like, it is more sort of...
fairy tale-ish maybe, or something.
Yeah,
a little bit like bedtime story.
Yeah,
like
a
almost
really...
tiny bit like Polonius, a little bit, maybe like wisdomy, but with a slight, you know, I don't know, goofiness to it, like, you know.
Yes, and it is
wise goofball.
And it is like really maybe kind of the first, like, it is the first, like, this is a metaphor in the poem, right?
Yeah,
like the pages of the Book of Love, you know.
Right. And that's another thing. I mean, that's a little more old fashioned technique that I don't probably use as much in the poems. And but I was going to say, you were talking about teaching, or just, I mean, I, you know, for me, I think I've taught, you know, as you have, I've taught a you know, different levels of students in different sorts of places, graduate students, undergraduates, high school students, all kinds of, you know, people in the community or whatever. And the one common thing I notice is that people have a lot of trouble just sort of staying with the basics of the poem, like its actual words and what it's actually saying and actually meaning. And I think a lot of, if you could put a lot of energy just into, as a teacher, just into refocusing the students into the poem itself and the words of it and what's happening word by word, phrase by phrase, line by line. I mean, that's something that I think that that readers just don't generally like know what to do. You know, I mean, so I do a lot of, you know, work in that area when I'm teaching.
Yeah. You know that poem Michiko Dead from Jack Gilbert's Great Fires?
Yes.
I teach that. That book is like such a great book to teach because it's like the language is very accessible, for lack of a better word.
Yeah.
But I have taught that poem over and over and over again as an example of like a controlling metaphor, right? Like that's the man holding the box.
Right.
That's all that happens is like a man holds a box and then he moves it around. And like, you know, I'll say like, well, what do you think? This is like a you know, what do you think he's talking? Like, what is it a metaphor for? You know, what is this poem about? Like, just that simple of a question. And students will be like, I don't know. I think it's about like, you know, the weight of, you know, mortality, or like, you know, the experience of being human.
Right.
And like,
sure.
You just
they want to go right to the big, huge ideas.
And it's like, read what does the title say? The title is you know, Michiko Dead. Like Michiko, it's not, you know, what is that? Probably a name. That's probably a name, you know. So then, like, oh, and then they go, oh, you know, and it's just like that little moment of like, oh, that's a part of the poem. It's an important.
Right. They don't read the title.
Yeah, they just
they don't
miss
read
the
title.
Title.
I mean, that's what the first, you know, quarter to a third of my book is basically about, which is sort of refocusing people on the literal meaning of the words, but in the interests of getting to a deeper, more mysterious place. Not to say, oh, all poetry should just be on the surface or should just be immediately obvious or clear or whatever, but you can't get anywhere if you don't attend to the words and the choices the poets have made.
Right.
It's not, I mean, it's, and any poet knows that instinctively, or most poets of any caliber know it. And like, it's just, but it's readers just don't, you know, they do exactly what you just said. They go straight for the, you know, for the big, huge, abstract, generalized meaning, which, by the way, usually happens to be banal. You know, it's like, you know, that those interpretations end up being completely banal and like obvious and things that we already knew. So the whole poem is just useless, essentially, if it's read that way. But and it's almost, I think there is a part of people that wants to, and I write about this in the book too, that, you know, a poem like that is a perfect example. It's like, it's very uncomfortable, that poem. It's intimate, and it's upsetting, and it's very physical, and it's like, people don't want, there's a part of us that draws instinctively away from that experience as people. And you know, I understand that, but I think sometimes people compensate by just trying to make it into some big abstract meaning experience that takes all the life out of it.
Right.
You know, and so, you know, we want to bring them, readers, back to the uncomfortable intimacy of an actual human statement.
Yes. Okay, Matthew, hold on 2 seconds. I'm going to get a note from Rebecca, and then I'll be right back. Okay. Okay, Matthew, I'm sorry, I'm back. Rebecca just wanted to point out that today in Austin, it's Hi, How Are You Day. You know, Daniel Johnston, the Austin artist. And
yeah, I do.
So she wanted to know if you know of his song and album called Frankenstein Love, and if any way that has informed. I don't know if it maybe informed even maybe the art.
No, I don't. I love Daniel Johnston, I've never heard of that album.
Well, it'd be interesting to ask the artist.
I wonder where that came from.
Yeah, maybe it informed the piece of art from which you are drawing the images.
It might have.
Images,
it might. Yeah. It might very well have done that. It's funny because I love Daniel Johnston's music, and I've been a big fan, but I just didn't know that album existed. Huh.
It's Hi, How Are You
Day. Interesting. But yeah, you might be right. Maybe that's where the Hi, How Are You Day, Austin.
Austin.
Oh, Austin.
I know, right? Okay, so I wonder if you could, I'm going to ask you to just say a couple of words about this James Tate poem, and then I'm going to ask you to read it, and then we will, I think we need to get out of the booth anyway, so then, so tell me about this poem and why you love it.
Well, James Tate was my teacher when I was in graduate school, one of my teachers, and he was, you know, a brilliant poet in person, and he died a few years ago, in 2015. And this is a poem from his 2001 collection, which is called Memoir of the Hawk. And it's actually the final poem in the book. And it's just, you know, it's got, Tate kind of has this way of telling a little story in his poems, in his later poems for sure, and then something kind of magical happens somewhere along the way. And I just love this poem so much. And so I thought, when you asked me to read a short poem, I thought this would be the one. This is James Tate's poem Rapture from his 2001 collection Memoir of the Hawk. Rapture. If you sit here a long time and are real quiet, you just might get to see one of those blue antelope, I said to Cora. I'd do anything to see a blue antelope, she said. I'd take off all my clothes and lie completely still in the grass all day. That's a good idea, I said. Taking off the clothes, I mean. It's more natural. I'd met Cora in the library the night before and had told her about the blue antelope, so we'd made a date to try to see them. We lay naked next to one another for hours. It was a beautiful, sunny day with a breeze that tickled. Finally, Cora whispered into my ear, My God, I see them. They're so delicate, so graceful. They're like angels, cornflower angels. I looked at Cora. She was disappearing. She was becoming one of them.
That was so wonderful. That was just, I love the way you read that poem. I really did. It's just it's a really fabulous
Thanks.
Poem.
Well, and I love him. I love Tate, and I love the poem.
Yeah, it's a great poem to hear out loud as well. You know, it's a great poem to hear over the radio, say. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to let you go, Matthew. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Good. Yeah,
Attend
okay,
to
I'll
your
talk
sick
to you
boy.
Soon.
Okay, bye.
Thanks. Okay, bye.
You can find Frankenstein Love and more great poems by Matthew Zapruder in his collection, Come On, All You Ghosts. This Is Just to Say is produced at KUT Radio in Austin, Texas. For KUT, I'm Carrie Fountain. Thanks for listening.